The Sunstone Theological Society presents Contemplative Christianity, the Modern Tradition, recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
And it is just a few seconds after 2 o'clock, so we shall already commence. I am Horace McMullen, asked to chair this session. I'm very happy to welcome all of you on behalf of Sunstone Symposium. This session will be concerned with contemplative Christianity, the modern tradition. It is my pleasure to introduce the speaker and the person who will follow up with comments afterward. We allow 30, or it may run to 34 or 35 minutes for our main speaker, and our commenter will be brief in remarks following. Then there will be an opportunity for questions. Dr. Robert Arway has had a varied, and I refrain from saying checkered, career with no less than 2 incarnations. He has for 21 years served directly as a Roman Catholic priest, having taught during that period of time at St. John's University and Niagara University. He received his Master of Arts from the Catholic University of America, his PhD from the Superior Institute of Philosophy in Louvain, Belgium. His doctoral thesis was on Godfrey of Fontaine, and he wrote the article about this scholastic philosopher for the Dictionary of Philosophy. He has served as Associate Professor of Philosophy at St. John's University and served as Vice Rector of Our Lady of Angels Seminary in Albany, New York. In a second incarnation, Dr. Arway altered the nature of his priesthood by getting married, which eventually equipped him for teaching marriage counseling, having taught the faith for 20 years. In this second incarnation, Dr. Arway has served on the staff of the Menninger Foundation, engaged in postdoctoral work at Zurich on Carl Jung. He has written articles for professional journals, has most recently served on the faculty at Weber State College, directing there the honors program. John Sillitoe will comment on the address. He has his B.S. in History from the University of Utah, another B.S. in Political Science from the same school, and an M.A. also from the University of Utah. He is presently archivist and assistant professor of library science at Weber State College. Prior to coming to Weber, he worked in the LDS Church Archives, has been a book review editor for Sunstone, and associate editor of the Sunstone Review, until recently book editor for Utah Holiday. He published various articles and reviews in Dialogue, Sunstone, Utah Historical Quarterly, and numerous other magazines and journals. It's my great pleasure to welcome these two men to our podium to present to us their thoughts on contemplative Christianity.
I'm very happy to be with you this afternoon. And before I get into my paper proper, I'd like to say that the remarks I will make will be based upon my own experience as well as the research that I've been able to pick. My experience with contemplation goes back quite a few years. I started contemplating when I was 12, I think. At that age, I went to what was called in Roman Catholic circles a preparatory seminary, and they taught me how to pray, how to meditate. And of course, I didn't know any of the theory behind it, but they taught me the practice, and for 6 years, I would get up every morning at 5:30 and meditate for half an hour. And then at that age, at the age of 18, I went into the novitiate, which is a concentrated hothouse place where they try to form your spirituality. And there I learned more of the theory of prayer and meditation and contemplation. And from that time onward, from the age of 18, until I left the priesthood in 1971, that would have been a period of about, I won't tell you how many years, probably something like 30, 40 years, I spent at least an hour a day in the practice of contemplation. I don't claim that that has taught me anything or that I know a great deal about this subject from experience, but at least I thought you might be interested in knowing that I've tried it. And so I will speak out of my own experience, but also try to supplement that with the reading that I've been doing on the topic. My topic is contemplation in the Western Christian tradition, with a focus on contemporary views. I use the word contemporary somewhat broadly to cover approximately the last 100 years. I shall deal directly only with the Christian tradition and therefore touch only obliquely, by way of incidental mention, on non-Christian contemplation, for example, on Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, and other non-Christian systems and practices. Finally, I shall not deal with contemplation in the Orthodox Eastern Christian Church traditions, but focus on the West. Even with these limitations, the topic remains quite unwieldy. The strategy I adopt is first to present a summary of one significant set of views current in Roman Catholic thinking during the 1960s. I then raise a number of issues suggested by this summary and developed by practitioners and theorists of other persuasions during the last century. Finally, I offer some reflections on various factors which affect the state of the questions at the present time. Roman Catholic theology of contemplation during the 1960s represented a rough consensus distilled from a long tradition rooted in the biblical context of Jewish and Christian scriptures. Jewish strands of tradition, reinterpreted in Christian experience and reflection, strongly affected contemplatives in their beliefs and practices. This complex tradition included such elements as, 1, the belief that there is more to reality than this physical world. 2, that this more than physical reality is an ultimate reality which is a personal God. 3, that this God created the world and mankind. 4, that mankind have spiritual souls that commune with God. 5, that God enters into covenants with humanity, for example, that with Abraham, Israel, and Jesus Christ. 6, that even in these covenants, the being of God and of man and woman remain ontologically distinct. 7, that these covenants are expressed in certain ritual acts, for example, circumcision, sacrifices, sacraments, and so on. 8, that the Torah and its commandments and Christian moral principles are expressions of God's will and affect relations between humans and God. In the course of centuries, the Christian Church used non-Christian philosophies, at first Neoplatonism, later Aristotelianism, Descartes' rationalism, and other systems, to reflect upon and explain religious beliefs. From the 3rd century, monastic orders developed from these very early times and proliferated in the Middle Ages and also during the Renaissance, leading to a variety of mystical theologies, and among them various schools of contemplatives, notably the Carmelite, Dominican, Franciscan, and Benedictine schools with variations and subtypes. In general, contemplation was thought to be a type of knowledge that is accompanied by delight and a degree of admiration for the object contemplated. As an operation of the cognitive powers, it could involve bodily vision, imagination, or intellect. By reason of its delight, it might overflow into the emotions and will, and if intense enough, it could even affect the body itself. As a kind of knowledge, it was thought to be different from discursive reasoning that goes step by step in arguments, and to be more like a direct intuition like an experience of intellectual insight or an aesthetic response to the beautiful. Contemplation itself was considered to be a disinterested, delightful gaze upon truth itself, not directed primarily to the practical life of action, though genuine contemplatives were to be distinguished from frauds by the moral goodness of their lives and their love for others. Depending on the truth contemplated and the faculties used, contemplation took different forms. Aesthetic contemplation, which is delightful vision of truth under the aspect of its beauty. Philosophical or scientific contemplation of truth as such. Theological contemplation, or a kind of intuitive gaze on God as known through reason, enlightened by faith. Acquired supernatural contemplation, or a simple gaze upon God known through faith and experienced through love. Mystical infused contemplation, or intuitive experience of union with God through faith, charity, and the gifts of wisdom and understanding. Normally, in Catholic theological vocabulary, contemplation's object is God, precisely as experienced through the supernatural gifts and virtues. That is what we ordinarily label as acquired supernatural and mystical infused contemplation. Mystical infused contemplation itself, which is perhaps the highest degree of contemplation in this tradition, admits itself of various degrees, with most modern theologians following the analysis made by St. Teresa of Avila, who lived in the 16th century, 1515 to 1582, though they don't always use her terminology. The first degree of mystical infused contemplation she mentions is infused recollection, which is followed by the prayer of quiet, in which the will is captivated even if the intellect may be somewhat distracted. The soul then advances to the prayer of union, which may be either simple union or it may be ecstatic union, terminating in what is called mystical espousal, and transforming union, terminating in mystical marriage. In simple union, imagination and memory are captivated. In ecstatic union, the external senses are alienated, resulting in ecstasy. And in transforming union, the soul is completely surrendered to God and enjoys a sort of permanent union in love and confirmation in grace. Those of you not familiar with this tradition may not understand the meaning of all those theological technical terms. So if you want to ask questions about them later, we'll have a chance, I hope, to do that. This brief summary provides a basis for my second step, which is to outline a number of issues raised by this account and that have exercised contemplatives and theorists for the past century. Most of these topics are intensely controverted by adherents with polarized views, arousing paradoxical questions. One such issue is focuses on calling contemplation an experience. William James's classic on the psychology of religion, The Varieties of Religious Experience, published in 1902, has influenced most subsequent noteworthy studies. James distinguished four marks of mystical experience. First, ineffability. That is, one cannot put the experience adequately into words. One must have the experience to understand it. Second, nonetheless, to those who have it, a kind of knowledge is gained, and mystics speak of revelations, illuminations, significance, meanings that are beyond concepts and rational discourse. Third, transiency. The experiences rarely last longer than a few hours, and in most cases, even less. And fourth, passivity. That is, no matter how hard one tries to have such experiences, they are always felt as gifts, and the person feels in the power of something superior, feels passive and acted upon rather than acting. James typifies a host of researchers who approached contemplation and other mystical phenomena from a psychological standpoint. Some of his critics say his four marks are too broad to be of any use and apply to many mutually exclusive experiences, for example, ethical, aesthetic, nature experiences, athletic and philosophical experiences, as well as mystical ones. Peter Moore, discussing ineffability points out, ironically, that mystics spend considerable effort and subtlety to describe the actual contents of their experience. So if it's, you can't really talk about it, and they go on for volumes talking about it, there's some kind of a question there, a problem, which we'll touch upon later about language. Dickens and others question the mark of transiency by emphasizing mystical states which the contemplative lives for whole periods of time, suggesting that the experience cannot be neatly separated from a way of life. The mark of passivity raises the question of the role of meditative techniques which contemplatives use. Are they merely preparatory and dispositive for contemplation, putting one in the mood, so to speak, to be passively seized? Or are they necessary and sufficient conditions, which, once fulfilled, result in the contemplative act or state? In other words, is contemplation not only an experience, but a technique or art that can be taught and learned with appropriate instruction and guidance? The Western Christian tradition has consistently emphasized the role of spiritual directors or guides using the arts of discernment of spirits to help novices avoid the pitfalls of illusion or self-deception and make solid progress in the contemplative life. In recent times, however, with increased awareness of other contemplative traditions, for example, the Buddhist, Sufi, and other Oriental and Middle Eastern techniques of meditation, there has been a turn to the East. Thomas Merton, for example, pleaded for openness to the great religions of the East and for dialogue with them, convinced that Christianity has much to learn from them about inner transformation, a deepening of unconsciousness toward the discovery of a transcendental dimension, these are his words, the discovery of a transcendental dimension of life beyond that of the ordinary self and of ethical and pious observations. Merton and others, for example, Johnston, were particularly attracted by Zen. This has raised questions of ecumenical possibilities, problems of distinguishing various types and degrees of contemplation. In my summary in the first part of my paper, it was evident that the standard Roman Catholic position recognized different kinds and degrees of contemplation. Not all Western theorists agree, however. Eminent authors can be cited who maintain that mystical experience is one and the same the world over. On the other hand, equally eminent authors argue for irreducibly plural forms of mystical experience. This controversy, given the fluidity of phenomenological descriptions of contemplative states, is likely to continue without much hope of settlement. It has been fruitful, however, in a couple of different yet related ways. For example, it has raised interesting questions about the relationships between experience and interpretation. And it has prompted analysis of the role of language in relation to contemplation. Let me briefly develop these two issues. The connection between experience and interpretation is much more complex than is sometimes supposed. Ordinarily, one thinks of interpretation as following after experience, or at best as simultaneous with it. One has an experience and interprets it either in the course of having it or at various removes in time afterwards. This is complicated enough, even in experiences of daily life. One meets a man or woman, feels a certain magical bond or antipathy, and in the meeting interprets it as love at first sight or instant mistrust. And for periods of time afterwards, one reads all sorts of significance into words, looks, and gestures. In accounts by contemplatives of their experiences, they interpret them as encounters with God the Father, with the risen Jesus, or Mary the Mother of God, or with Yahweh, with Brahma, the ultimate reality, or the deepest self, and so on. In other words, the experience is interpreted according to the cultural, social, religious, institutional, and personal beliefs, and numerous other factors that are context-related. Some analysts recently have added a new emphasis, namely that all these factors influence experience even before it occurs. They create expectations, desires, mindsets, psychological frameworks, which condition the experience beforehand, make it to be of one sort rather than another. So a Jew comes to the experience with a different mindset than a Christian or than a Buddhist and so on, and as a result of that, they experience differently from each other. They suggest, then, that this fact argues for a multiplicity of kinds of experience in contemplation, diversity that is not only cultural, but even individual. Linguistic analysts, too, suggest that traditional assumptions about contemplative language, the reports that contemplatives give us of their experiences, need to be re-examined. Discussions of ineffability are, according to them, on the wrong track if mystical writings are assumed to be descriptive. They might better be considered as types of transformative speech. For example, exhortations to conversion, or recommendations about the ideal way of life, or poetic creations, refashioning experience. Many commentators point out that the wide variety of interpretations of contemplative reports, typically seem designed to support or promote a specific doctrinal viewpoint, or at least to be influenced by the interpreter's creedal affiliation. This sometimes leads to various arguments about the orthodoxy or heterodoxy of contemplative reports, even attempts to institutionalize the contemplative life, for example, in Roman Catholic religious orders and monasteries, even to threats of excommunication, or at least warnings about dangerous doctrines and heresy. Does that sound familiar? The ambivalence of the Roman Catholic institutional church since the 1960s Vatican II interlude is reflected in the stances that, on the one hand, the spirit cannot be chained and blows where it wills, while on the other hand, the church's teaching office needs to protect the flock from false prophets and from the devil who goes about like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. Underlying many of the issues and concerns already mentioned are further questions about the objectivity of contemplative reports. In one sense, it is a question of the veracity of the reports. How is one to distinguish the genuine from the frauds, well-intentioned illusions from clear-sighted authenticity, neurotic or psychotic episodes from reality-oriented data? In another sense of objective, what are the possible objects intended by alleged contemplative activity? In this connection, various candidates have been offered. William James apparently was content to speak of, quote, something larger than ourselves, unquote, in union with which we find our greatest peace, quote, anything larger will do, unquote. Others proposed the triune God. That's the object of contemplation. Still others, the whole of nature, in so-called nature contemplation, or one's own spiritual substance. Jungians are kind of strong on that. The idea that the self, which is the goal of human development, is somehow grasped or intuited in a contemplative state. Others propose that in contemplation one contacts angelic or demonic powers. This is a characteristic of the Jewish tradition. Or a variety of archetypes of good and evil, once again, the Jungians. James believed that, quote, no specific intellectual content may be identified, but that mystical experience may be united with highly different philosophies and theologies, and do not prove the creeds of any particular one. Many studies concur with James that no true propositions can result from mystical experience. For example, Stephen Katz, while he denies that mystical claims are so much mumbo-jumbo and refuses to reduce them to psychological projections, asserts that, quote, no veridical propositions can be generated on the basis of mystical experience. Carl Keller bluntly states, quote, the student of mysticism cannot reach beyond his own personal experience, unquote. This skepticism is not universal, however. Epistemological studies by various, mostly Catholic thinkers like Joseph Maréchal, Louis Dupré, Jacques Maritain, and others, claim sufficient grounds can be found for taking the truth claims of contemplatives seriously. So once again, there's a polarized view. Some saying you can't establish any truth from their claims. Others saying, oh yeah, there's good grounds for it. One of the criticisms of contemplation common in the West is that the contemplative withdraws from the world of common life, human social needs and concerns, relationships, and the seamy underside of the conflicted evil problems of daily nitty-gritty existence. The image of the contemplative as inhabiting power, an elite exception to the common run of human beings, contributing nothing to the welfare or progress of the human race, has drawn a variety of responses. That of Thomas Merton was fairly typical. Merton criticized the narcissistic quietism, the substitution of drugs for love, and the sickly preoccupation with self in much of modern Western culture, as well as among contemplatives. For him, the genuine contemplative takes full responsibility for herself, for himself, for others, and for the world. His or her identity is found not only in God, but also in others. For the contemplative life is impossible, he says, without a genuine love for others. Contemplation, in his view, releases energies which could transform the world through social action. The contemplative, he said, and these are his words, is concerned with the same problems as other people, but will try to get to the spiritual and metaphorical roots of these problems not by analysis, but by simplicity. I'm not sure I understand what he means by that, simplicity, but it's obviously a virtue. Merton likewise criticized the pseudo-spirituality of activism, claiming that no amount of social action could replace spiritual transformation and enlightenment. He perceived the dangers in political delusions and of trusting in slogans and the tactics of pressure groups. In his words, he who attempts to act and do things for others or the world without deepening his own self-understanding, freedom, integrity, and capacity for love will not have anything to give to others. He will communicate nothing but the contagion of his own obsessions, his aggressiveness, his ego-centered ambitions, his delusions about ends and means, his doctrinaire prejudices and ideas. Other theorists, reflecting the long tradition of socially active contemplatives, that is, the saints, emphasize the relation between contemplation and action. Karl Rahner writes, for example, "It must be realized that in earthly man, this emptying of self will not be accomplished by practicing pure inwardness, but by real activity, which is called humility, service, love of our neighbor, the cross, and death. One must descend into hell together with Christ, lose one's soul not directly to the God who is above all names, but in the service of one's brethren." As for the charge of elitism, Rahner also points out that the contemplative simply lives out to the full the vocation of all human beings to respond to the transcendent orientation of their lives. This suggests the need for a re-examination of the connotations of elitism and to sort out smugness from genuine striving for excellence. By way of summary, then, some basic issues focusing contemporary discussion of contemplation are the following. One, is contemplation an experience, a technique, or an interpretation of reality? Two, if it is an experience, is it one, many, or does it admit of degrees? Three, are contemplatives victims of illusion, or do they really contact something? If so, what? Four, is it possible to distinguish frauds from genuine articles? Five, how are private and public integrated by the contemplative? That is, how is contemplation related to action? Communities. Theologians, conservative and progressive, try to integrate contemplation with traditional Christian beliefs and doctrines, or reinterpret the tradition in new ways in the light of contemplative reports. Increasing awareness of apparently similar phenomena in other cultures inspire both ecumenical hopes and cautious reserve about over-identifying disparate elements. Loss of confidence in organized religious institutions motivates an ongoing search for significance and meaning in a world where the fragility of goodness is keenly felt and where the contemplative life looks like a way of coping with it. Let me close with an image. The word contemplation contains within it the Latin root templum, temple. This word originally referred to the space marked out from profane space for contact with the holy. This suggests that contemplation occurs within whatever holy space one is able to discover and involves all the responses appropriate thereto. This image will say different things to each of us here today, and I leave you to contemplate it at your leisure.
Over to you.
As I read Bob Arway's paper last night, I was struck by the difference that I find in the Mormon tradition regarding contemplation. Mormonism, it seems to me, seems to mistrust the whole idea of a contemplative approach. I'm always thinking of a fast meeting experience, for example, and there'll be a lull in the action as people are not bearing their testimony but are simply thinking about what they may have heard or contemplating on other matters that are in their own minds or whatever. And somebody will inevitably stand up and say, I hate to see this time being wasted. There's a whole idea that that if we're not involved in activity, we are then wasting time. We are an activity-oriented religion, a religion that believes we are saved by works, not by contemplation. We are dogged by statistics of visits and ceilings and attendance itself. Indeed, one who is not participating to the fullest in the Mormon faith is described as being inactive. Now, I understand that in current terminology, that term, I'm a little bit shaky on my activity, I guess, we no longer say one is inactive, we say one is less active. Now, I find that an interesting way of approaching that. Some of us, like me, whose hairline are receding, can then go out into the world and not say we are balding, but we are simply less hairy. I think there are two areas in which the idea of contemplation, as I understand it, and it has been expressed in Bob Arway's presentation, fits into the Mormon scheme. One is the whole idea that we have of fasting and prayer, of trying to tune our body and mind and spirit into one and make that in tune with God. The other experience, or the other place where many people experience a contemplative experience is in the temple. At least that's what I've been told. I've never had that experience myself. As Bob has suggested, we are able to contemplate in whatever holy space is available to us. Bob Arway has given us an insightful and informative overview of contemplation in contemporary Western Christian tradition. It is, as he calls it, a puzzling and challenging phenomena. As he mentions in the paper and is important in my comments, contemplation and what I call activism are linked. Bob specifically focuses on Catholic theology of contemplation since the 1960s. I found in his summary, for example, several aspects which to me seem to fit a Mormon mode. As he suggests, contemplation is context-related, affected by the culture and religious beliefs and personal characteristics of the individuals involved. Contemplation is, and as I say, this is something that I think fits into a Mormon framework as well, believes that reality transcends this world, that the ultimate reality is God, that God created the world, that mankind can communicate with God, that there are covenants between God and humans, that ritual acts express these covenants, and that moral principles, a personal worldview, if you will, can be expression of God's will. What I'd like to do in the next few minutes is take a somewhat different tack and consider several key elements that I found in this paper. I'd like to touch upon them, and I think speak from a largely Mertonian perspective, particularly in terms of the question of contemplation and action. I was impressed with the whole idea of contemplation being the opposite of a step-by-step reasoning process, a willingness to be open to different approaches, direct intuitive approaches. It's something that's not easy for me to do, and for me this raised some important questions. The other issue that I found quite interesting was the idea that contemplation does not necessarily mean an avoidance or withdrawal from the world. to turn to Thomas Merton, who criticized, as Bob says, a narcissistic quietism, emphasis on the drug culture or preoccupation with self that he was witnessing in the mid to late 60s as he was writing. As Bob indicates, for him, the contemplative takes full responsibility for herself or himself, for others, and for the world. Key elements in this Mertonian concept are the idea that identification can be found in God and in others, that contemplation is impossible without love, that contemplation releases energy which then can be used to transform the world, to change things, and as he says, to seek to root itself in a simplicity. As I have read the writings of Thomas Merton in a modest way, I'm struck by what he has to say about the contemplative experience. In one book that I read, he talks about the fact that many people think of contemplation as strange or esoteric. He denies that. He says that contemplation is, and again, this is something that strikes a sort of a Mormon chord in me, the work of the Holy Ghost acting upon our souls through the gift of wisdom and understanding. Contemplation, he argues, is a gift from God for those who desire to receive it. And it will not be given, he suggests, to those who willfully remain at distance from God. Merton identifies contemplation, a form of it, as in the term he uses, as active contemplation. He suggests that it uses the imagination, theology, philosophy, art, and music, and other things to help us know and to love God and to know God's will. Moreover, active contemplation, he suggests, demands thought, action, and acts of will. Its function is to turn our hearts toward God and to know God better. It prepares the way of love through the teaching of obedience, humility, and it teaches us to seek to please God rather than simply enjoy the satisfactions of the world. He further observes that the great majority of Christians will not become pure contemplatives, but would not necessarily be unfamiliar with the graces akin to contemplation. In his writings, he suggests that contemplation is the light of God playing directly upon the soul. A key element is to find God and love through prayer. A second point that he mentions is that we need to come to a realization of what God is doing to our own soul, and contemplation is a way of doing this, that we need to become more trusting in faith. And more importantly, that we not confuse contemplation with quietism. Quietism, he describes as a condition where humans enclose within themselves in an entirely selfish solitude, which excludes not only other humans, but God as well. Contemplation, he suggests, is the perfection of love. Quietism, the rejection of love. Again, he speaks in terms of an activist contemplation. In a book he wrote called What is Contemplation, he says this, which is important, I think, in understanding the value of contemplation in moving people to action. The great work of love, which will be performed in many obscure and weak and unknown men and women, those who are not pure contemplatives, Christians despised by the world and cast aside as useless, men suffering in prisons and concentration camps, women starving in the bombed cities of the world, laborers, poor farmers, humble priests, nuns in convents, simple lay brothers, mothers of families, and even little children. In these souls, Christ will enkindle in the latter days of the world the fire of a great charity to counteract the love which has grown cold in the souls of the lords of the earth. So for Thomas Merton, contemplation is something that is available and to the ordinary people of the world who are dealing with the world around them. Let me just take 1 minute and give one final example, which for me is an example of an activist contemplation, bringing together the ideas expressed by Merton and others. And I find that found in the life of Cesar Chavez. Many of you may be aware that at this point, Chavez, the leader of the United Farm Workers, is engaged in a fast. It's been going on for more than a month now, a combination of fast and meditation, to focus attention not only on the condition of the farm workers in California, perhaps the most oppressed workers in this country, but to make people think and consider choosing a different course, specifically the use of harmful pesticides in treating grapes. What he is doing, I think, as a contemplative, is focusing on his individual act as a way of arousing a social conscience. He is indeed trying to release that energy of love that Bob talked about in his paper. Let me just read what he had to say as he began this fast. "This fast is first and foremost personal. It is something I feel compelled to do. It is directed at myself. It is a fast for the purification of my own body, mind, and soul. The fast is also a heartfelt prayer for purification and strengthening for all of us." He goes on to discuss the crisis of pesticides and from this contemplative position. "The solution to this deadly crisis will not be found in the arrogance of the powerful, but in solidarity with the weak and the helpless. I pray to God that this fast will be a preparation for a multitude of simple deeds for justice carried out by men and women whose hearts are focused on the suffering of the poor and who yearn with us for a better world. Together, all things are possible. It is this kind of contemplation which seeks to find God's will within ourselves and to integrate the private and public, which is the most important aspect of the subject of contemplation for me." Thank you.
Well, you have both given us considerable meat to chew upon, and I wondered first whether there were any questions concerning terms. There, you were fully aware of what ontological and epistemological and various other terms were. Whether you wanted to reveal your ignorance in that case or not, I leave up to you. Yes.
I wanted to ask Bob, because he used the word mysticism several times, is it understood that contemplation should lead to that mystical state for whatever purposes and however defined it may be by the individual?
Yeah. Does contemplation lead to mysticism?
Yes, I think that the term mysticism is broader than contemplation. It involves all kinds of phenomena beside contemplation, but contemplation is a mystical phenomenon in my understanding of it. And mystical in this sense, that in the contemplative state or act, one is somehow introduced into the mystery of salvation, I think we could say, that, or the mystery of the ultimate reality, or whatever name you want to give that, God, Brahma, etc. The word mystic comes from a word that means to keep quiet. And the origin of it was that the mystic had experiences which he wasn't going to reveal to other people because of their holiness. And they're so mysterious, therefore, for a number of reasons. They're profound, holy things, and not to be abused by common speech. And the contemplative is at the mystical level, I would say. Now, I should qualify that just a bit and say that in the Western tradition, there is an argument that there are forms of contemplation which are not mystical. They are acquired by our own efforts. And that's a kind of a intramural controversy, that there is a thing which is not mystical contemplation in the sense I've just been talking about, but it is a kind of an acquired way of, by your own power, of just concentrating your own thinking. Now, if you want to call that mystical in a broad sense, and the other mystical in a strict sense, where God takes over and, overpowers one's own thinking, then you might be able to resolve that intramural controversy.
Well, Joseph Smith's assertion about his experiences, say, with his so-called first vision,
yes,
could not be mystical because, first of all, he spoke of it, and secondly, because it laid the foundations for a theological structure.
Uh-huh. Did everyone hear the comment?
Okay. The comment is that was Joseph Smith's first experience mystical because he was able to speak about it, and it became the foundation of a doctrinal system, I suppose. Neither one of those rules it out as a mystical experience. All the mystics talk about their experiences. Even though what they say is, on one side of the mouth, they say, "I can't tell you what it was like, it's impossible to put into words. Now let me see, it was like this, and like this." On the other side of their mouth. See, so the fact that they talk about it and try to express it doesn't rule it out as a mystical experience. And the fact that a doctrinal system is worked out of it, it doesn't rule it out either, because what are doctrinal systems but attempts to organize in conceptual terms something which has been experienced? In other words, faith seeking understanding.
Question back here.
I have a little comment that I'm going to focus into question. I'm fascinated by the whole thing of contemplation, in part because I've lived in my life where contemplative efforts are becoming more and more common rather than day, and it sort of forced me to come to grips with it. But it seems like in Mormonism there's a kind of silent contemplation that is there inherent in our tradition that's kind of lost in the face of the activism. And in my mind, the real expression of that comes to testimony meeting, where the essence of the meeting is that kind of emotive communication that we're all supposed to have with the Spirit, and where the Spirit bears witness to the members of the Church. And the whole metaphor of testimony seems to be a metaphor for the contemplative experience, because how do you obtain a testimony? But in those quiet moments where you actually sit and commune with the Lord, sure, you can study it out, you can work it out, you can do all the active things. But when push comes to shove, it seems like, at least in the meetings that I've been hearing lately, the central thing is the mystical act of communing with God. Mm-hmm. And I know that people are focusing a lot more attention on the kind of emotional nature of that communication. And I'm wondering if that isn't perhaps a massive emphasis on contemplation within Mormon's sort of name.
I would say so, yes. And see, the trouble with Western mysticism is it's been contaminated, or theories about mysticism, contaminated so much by Cartesian, Descartes' rationalism. That's 17th century rationalist who reduced the human being to thinking. The human being is a thinking thing. And forgot that all those aspects of humanity which are emotive, appetitive, non-thinking aspects, which equally get us in touch with reality in different ways than thought does. And so, I'm sure that every one of you in here is a contemplative. It's possible to be a human being without being contemplative in a broad sense. We have this difficulty with making distinctions between different kinds of contemplation, but you can't be a human being without reflecting, without thinking about yourself and what's going on in your life and talking to yourself. It's perfectly human to talk to yourself. And what you're talking to yourself is expressing your meditative states. And depending on, how profound that inner dialogue with yourself goes, is the depth of your contemplation. And some of you, I think, are probably very deeply contemplative.
John, do you have a comment on that?
Address that.
Well, I think that's at least theoretically possible, and that's you've raised a good point. That's something that I hadn't thought about it that, in that same way. I guess my experience with fast and testimony meeting has been that they tended to be more like report meetings, how the family was doing, where people had been, miracles of saving missionaries, that sort of thing. But I think you raise a good point that is another area that could be used that way. I'd like to be going to maybe your fast and testimony meeting, Dave.
Here, and then back to you.
Yeah. Oh, I think it's kind of interesting that people think that mystical experiences cannot be expressed, that you can't realize that you can't write now or whatever. Because I think that any phenomenon can be studied empirically. There's a journal, a scientific study of religion. You can take phenomena and you can study across culturally, across periods of time. And these experiences that people think are unique to them or to their belief system, really aren't. They can be explained. So I think, people keep them in the silent to themselves. Well, I guess maybe they like to think they're the one that has experienced something like this. But, it's really a universal experience. I was thinking about my husband. He said he knew that he should marry me because he was sitting in church and he had this warm feeling going through. Well, he had just come back from a mission, 2 years without being around a girl. And I'm sure his hormones were just surging. I was getting the girl who knew and I was there and I was available. But to me, mystical experience.
Ah, sweet,
I guess everybody heard
life.
That. The woman in the red first.
Dr. Arway, I have a personal question, and I'm trying to think of a way to phrase this.
Don't be afraid. You won't offend me. Go ahead.
But I'm curious about your personal experiences that you mentioned briefly.
Yeah.
About particularly what they were like, and then it wasn't clear to me if post-71...
Okay, that's a fair and honest question. I'll try to give an honest response. There were times up until 71, and when I was more or less systematically and daily devoting an hour to meditation and contemplation every day, except for those days when I slept in. There were times when I really felt taken out of myself, that there was some kind of a power which had taken over, and I was not aware of anything around me for periods of half hour, 45 minutes to an hour. And that time went like that. And I would come out of it and not realize I'd been doing this for an hour. I'm sure many of you have had similar experiences, and I don't claim any special powers or, that I'm anything different from a lot of people in that regard.
Thank you.
A lot of it was dry. A lot of it was arid times when nothing happened, and I just sat there like a stick, and tried to contemplate and couldn't. And so it was not a pleasant... And that's a very common phenomenon, too, in prayer, that so-called dark night of the senses and dark night of the soul. Something similar to what writers go through when they get writer's block. They just get, nothing comes. And I don't think it's, I think there are parallels in other kinds of things than. But since then, if you want an answer to that question, I haven't devoted myself explicitly to it, but I just can't stop being contemplative. I'm thinking all the time, and at times I do in various ways, more dealing with people. For example, in teaching a class, sometimes I just get so intensely wound up into something. Contemplating an idea, I just lose pretty much a sense of being and anybody else being there, and I'm just going. And I'm just talking, trying to express this vision I have in my head. And then, an hour goes by, and I said, is it time's up?
Thank you. We've got three more questions at least, or four. The gentleman back there.
My question for Mr. Silico is, we are overlooking the obvious 15 minutes each Sunday when my site for the Eucharist is just that farmers are supposed to be contemplating of God.
Yeah, I think you're right. That is another institutional time of contemplation. And I suppose that one of the limitations of my response is that I'm not very involved institutionally. For those people who are involved, that would again provide an institutional time. Yeah, it is the obvious.
The lady back thing?
You.
Oh. Yes.
If I interpret what correctly, meditation leading to a mystical experience of some sort is not exactly a core saving activity even in the Catholic tradition. That is, while we find examples of it, it is amongst people who either feel called to a vocation of pursuing the mystic tradition, or people simply do it on their own. I do not believe that any teaching in Mormonism precludes one's going forth to seek that kind of spiritual experience and practice. In fact, unlike academic experience, against which we are warned on a regular basis, I do not know that the church has ever been the least bit concerned that its people involve themselves individually and privately in various spiritual practices. Do I miss on both counts?
Better speak to the
church. Would you rephrase the question as you heard it? One question I hear is mysticism or contemplation in itself salvific?
You can handle that one.
There were various ramifications.
Okay, I'll handle that one. I think it is. I think there's a relationship to salvation, that the mystic reaches in the purest form of human experience, I'll call it an experience, what all of us are striving for. In other words, I made a reference at the end of my paper to the fragility of goodness, that the good life is very fragile. It can be threatened by many things outside and inside us. And this has been the concern of all people from the Greeks' tragedy to the present, to protect the good life. And contemplation is one way of doing it, that you, in that state, you overcome all the threats to the good life. Nothing can touch you in that state. And so I think it is a soteriological phenomenon, if you want me to use some jargon. It's a salvation experience. And it's quite well related to the need that we all experience to have some safety in the good life.
John, do you have a comment?
I'm not sure I completely understand your last point, but I think I heard what I think you said.
Could you get right on mic?
Sorry. From a less active perspective, I think you're right, that there isn't a particularly strong emphasis, with the exceptions of the things we've mentioned today. At least I don't hear it very often. I do hear this view that somehow time spent meditating or contemplating is time wasted, and I think that's unfortunate.
We thank you both very much for a very stimulating, provocative, and nurturing session.